anyone, really. But this notion that saying that Black Lives Matter automatically means that cop lives don't matter, or that white lives or Asian lives or any other lives don't matter, I think is a fallacy that we really need to smash that. Because what the point is that Black people are being killed by police at an alarming rate. And whether or not it is more of a rate than it has been in the past, certainly the attention to it due to things like, you know, citizen journalism, cell phones and that sort of thing. Certainly the conversation has been changed so that we are focusing on this police brutality. And the notion that the president speaking out for Black Lives Matter automatically means he's against the police, or the same thing happened with Bill de Blasio. With you had New York City police officers turning their backs on the mayor because he has a black son and dared to speak about things that he knows are going to affect his son and affect his family. I think that we need to do, I don't know what can be done about that, but we need to stop that thinking. We need to make it so that this country, Americans, the police, the government values black lives, but also realizes that black people aren't saying that only our lives matter, but that our lives matter as well.
We're going to have to leave it there. And I want to thank you very much for all being with us. Again, in our headline today, we said an African-American U.S. citizen has applied for asylum in Canada, saying he fears he'll be killed by police in the United States because simply he is black. You can go back to our headlines to check that news story. Thank you so much to David K. Johnson and Mani Gandhi, as well Jameel Smith and John Nichols. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Next up is the evening news.
I'm Sonny Blechinger, KBOO's artist in residence for 2015. I hope you'll tune in on October 29th at 10 p.m. for my radio play, The Pool. It's about four people that happen to swim at the same public pool every week. And even though they don't know each other, they've mostly decided they don't like each other. And you get to hear their thoughts.
I don't know what I was thinking. Swimming. This is horrible.
So please tune in for the world premiere, really, of The Pool on October 29th. At 10 p.m. It'll be fun, like swimming.
People love swimming in the Crystal Plunge.
God, that creepy lifeguard is still staring at me.
Okay, let's just put the stuff down and...
This is my time. My time in the pool.
KBOO Community Radio is preparing for our legendary book and record sale. We're currently accepting your donations of books, comics, LPs, CDs, DVDs. Your discards are another person's treasure, and all sales benefit your community radio station, KBOO. So bring your donations down to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue between 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. weekdays. If you've got a larger donation, call us at 503-231-8032, extension 213, to arrange a time for a volunteer to come pick it up. Questions? 503-231-8032, extension 213, or email volunteer@kboo.org. The last day to donate is Tuesday, November 10th, so don't wait. Bring in those CDs, LPs, books, DVDs right away. And thank you for your support of Community Radio, KBOO, Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the People's Republic of China has announced it will start allowing couples to have two children, formally ending the country's controversial one-child policy.
A proposed merger between energy companies Exelon and Pepco Holdings has been revived after it was rejected by regulators last August.
And yesterday, the Portland City Council released $61,000 in an effort to alleviate the city's housing crisis.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 29th, 2015. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Sarika Mehta. The Portland City Council yesterday released $61 million to ease the city's housing crisis. This is in addition to the $200 million promised by Mayor Hales to address the lack of affordable housing in Portland. The money, which will be spent over the next decade, is designed to ensure affordable units are constructed as gentrifying continues in North and Northeast Portland. Kurt Krager, the Housing Bureau director, said the money should help generate more than 600 units. The top priorities for funding will be $7 million for the Home for Everyone initiative, $10 million plus 40 Section 8 vouchers to develop two publicly owned properties in Northeast Portland, and $5 million for development in the Lentz neighborhood. Developers will be allowed to submit bids on the new affordable housing projects until January, and the projects will begin construction in March.
The Northwest Grocery Association has launched a new initiative to privatize liquor sales here in Oregon. The initiative, if passed, would end Oregon's current system of only allowing hard liquor sales through a limited number of state-licensed stores that are overseen by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Such a change would let consumers purchase liquors with the same ease with which they purchase beer and wine. Previous initiatives attempted by the Grocery Association back in 2014 were dropped after facing opposition from beer and wine distributors. Opponents to those initiatives were against the taxes, aimed at producing as much revenue as the state now makes as the only liquor retailer. This time, the Northwest Grocery Association's initiative leaves the tax questions for the legislature to decide. Sponsors will have to collect 88,184 valid signatures by next July in order to qualify for the general election ballot in November of 2016. A similar privatization initiative in Washington back in 2011 sparked that state's most expensive ballot measure fight ever.
Tonight at 6 p.m. at Portland State University's Native American Student and Community Center, there will be a discussion on decolonization and political prisoners. Speakers at this event include Ajamu Umi, with the Portland chapter of the All African People's Revolutionary Party, Kent Ford, founder of the Portland Black Panther Party and father of Patrice Lumumba Ford, and Chauncey Pelter, son of Leonard Pelter and co-director of the International Leonard Pelter Defense Committee. KABU reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Minister Pelter to find out more.
Leonard Pelter is 71 years old. He lives in a Coleman maximum security prison. He's been in there for 40 years. He's one of the longest-held political prisoners in the United States, one of the biggest rights violation cases in U.S. history. And back in the 70s, there was the Pine Ridge Reservation. There was a it was called the Reign of Terror, and from around 76, there was over 62 Native Americans who were murdered and mutilated, and there was never no investigation, never no arrest over this. So the Indians on the Pine Ridge Reservation at this time was pretty terrified. They were all pretty terrified for their lives. And well, in the 70s, the Goon Squad, president of the Pine Ridge Reservation, Dick Wilson, was pretty much pointing at them. They were running around and kicking the doors in on the elders and wanting them to sign the mineral rights over and stuff like that. And the elders, they'd asked Payne to come in and help, ask them for help. And so Leonard and some other young men, they all got together and they went back there, and they were helping the elders any way they could. They were, you know, fixing up their windows and doing stuff for them around there, whatever they needed around there, you know, helping them out. And there is pretty much for protection over the elders. Well, on one of these days, that summer day, there was two unmarked vehicles following a red pickup on the reservation. Nobody's, you know, everybody at that time was terrified for their lives. Well, a firefighter cured. And when the smoke cleared, there was two dead FBI agents, which I imagine everybody in the shootout thought they were shooting out two of the goon squads, which ones were everybody was terrified for their lives. So they all scattered, and when they caught them, four of them. They let one go. We must not have enough on him. The other two, Bobby and Dino Butler, they brought them to Wichita, Kansas. Well, they had pleaded self-defense and got acquitted. Well, then they had Leonard Pelter, and they drug him back from Canada on rights violations, tempered witnesses. We even let his defense submit real defense. So they got him back over here, and they decided they weren't going to bring him back to Wichita, Kansas. They were bringing him up to North Dakota, where they had a known racist judge, an all-white jury. They had a Myrtle Poorbear, a mentally ill, sick Native woman. They had her write up some affidavits saying she was Leonard Peltier's girlfriend, and he was bragging about all this. Never seen her a day in his life. It just goes on and on from there. Well, there you go. It's one of the, it's known all over the country as one of the biggest rights violation cases in the U.S. And we're asking for clemency.
So now tell us about the event that you're speaking at this evening at Portland State, Decolonization and Political Prisoners.
Yeah, we got a couple other little groups there, Jericho and some other people that are going to have some family members from, say, ex-Black Panthers that was had rights violations and stuff like that still done to them. We're all going to speak and try to get everybody aware of what's going on and just asking for support for, you know, this justice system that we all live by every day. You know, we got to live by a justice system. It's pretty nice if they go by it and we can live according to the justice system. We can live by the justice system instead of worrying about if we say something and we walk outside, they don't like what we're saying, we go to jail. Or they're already tapping our phones, you know. People don't realize we're losing more and more rights every day. And it's supposed to be one of the freest, proudest countries in America. And I just like to keep it that way. Because I love living here and I like my freedom. So we're not asking anybody to do anything wrong or anything. We're just asking everybody to be aware and be aware of everybody's rights in America. You know. And that leads back to some of these people we'll be talking about tonight.
Now, just wanted to ask, I saw on your website, whoisleonardpeltier.info, there's a call to action asking people to urge the Federal Bureau of Prisons to move your father to a medium security facility. Could you tell us about that and the reasons?
Yeah, well, my father, like I was saying, he's 71 years old. He's got diabetes. His blood pressure's high. And he's in a Coleman maximum security prison. And that's a pretty nasty looking place. It's known as a gang prison. Well, they're constantly in lockdown to the gang fights and stuff in there. And they lock him down. He ain't getting the proper diet food like he's getting. And of course his blood pressure goes up and his sugar level goes up, which makes his health not that good. And for the past years, his health hasn't been very good anyway. And that's just not a very good place for a 71-year-old man with diabetes, poor health. And we're just asking for Leonard to get at least move to a medium security prison and some clemency for this man.
Again, this evening's event is 6 to 8 p.m., Portland State University, Native American Student and Community Center, Decolonization and Political Prisoners. I've been speaking with Chauncey Peltier. He'll be speaking there tonight. He's the son of Leonard Peltier, co-director of the International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee. The other speakers are going to be Kent Ford, who's the founder of the Portland Black Panther Party and the father of Patrice Lumumba Ford, and also Ajamu Umi, who's with the Portland chapter of the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Chauncey, thank you so much.
Thank you guys very much. Thank you for your support for Leonard.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
A new Associated Press poll shows increasing support for stricter gun laws across the United States. The new poll shows that 58% of Americans have said gun laws should be made tighter. That's an increase from 52% 2 years ago. This latest poll was conducted 2 weeks after the shooting at Umpqua Community College down in Roseburg, Oregon, that took 10 lives, including the shooter's life. It was also published on the same day that an Oregon gun control group issued its agenda for the coming legislative session. Oregon's Cease Fire has long pushed for stricter gun laws in the state legislature. Its new 10-page proposal calls for higher standards for gun ownership, for tighter restrictions on federally licensed gun dealers and for improved safety standards for gun owners. The group made it clear that they respect the Second Amendment and support gun owners' rights, but they want to ensure that guns are kept out of the hands of small children and that they are used responsibly. Also this week, a report was released finding that no one really knows how many guns there are here in the United States, mainly due to a 1996 ban on federal funding for firearms research. Numerous states have passed laws in the past 5 years that make once public data on gun ownership now confidential. This makes Ceasefire Oregon's work more difficult since they don't know exactly how many guns there are, either in Oregon or in the United States as a whole.
A commission that rejected a proposed merger between nuclear energy giant Exelon Corporation and Pepco Holdings back in August has announced this week their intention to offer the parties involved a fast-track process to get the deal approved. If approved, the acquisition will make Exelon the largest utility company in the nation and double its customer base. KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke with Watchdog Group Public Citizen for more.
I'm talking with Allison Fisher. She is the Outreach Director at Public Citizens Energy Program. Thanks so much for making yourself available for our listeners today.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to talk about the shift in position with regard to the District of Columbia Public Service Commission and a proposed merger between Exelon Corporation and Pepco Holdings, Inc. From what I've been able to learn, this merger was first proposed in April of 2014 and ultimately rejected by the D.C. Public Service Commission just a couple of months ago. But the same commission now wants to, quote-unquote, fast-track this merger. Has anyone affiliated with the commission spoken to what change that caused such a turnaround?
Just to be clear, the Public Service Commission, what they actually have decided to do is to allow for an expedited review process. Now, this is interesting because it doesn't mean that they ultimately are going to approve the deal. It just means that they're allowing for what we feel is an inadequate amount of time for public interest groups to engage in this process, have ample hearings, have ample time for the public to really understand and have kind of the terms of this new settlement kind of unfold and people to really get a good sense of what it will mean for the district, what it will mean for consumers, what it will mean for the future of energy in the district going forward, and not confident that we have enough time to do that. On the other hand, because the Public Service Commission has decided to expedite the review process, it is possible that they're doing so because, quite frankly, they're confident with the decision that they made in August to reject Exelon's bid to take over Pepco, and that they feel that they don't need as much time to do the same thing again.
Was there an opportunity for the affected publics to have a chance to weigh in at that time? Did they weigh in, and on which side of the question as to whether or not these two entities should merge?
The public did have an opportunity to weigh in. Public hearings around this particular takeover took place in December and January of last year. What the commission said in their order is very telling about how the public engaged. In their order, when they rejected the merger, they said that this was the most heavily participated in proceeding in the century-old history of this public service commission. So no other issue in the entire time that this public service commission has been in existence has garnered as much attention from the public as this one. And to be clear, and what they also confirmed in their order was the majority of that public was in opposition to this merger. There was, I think, 4 or 5 public hearings in different regions throughout the district, in addition to a comment period where people could email or mail in or deliver their personal comments. So all of those were taken into consideration and helped the Public Service Commission get to the decision that they did, which was this merger could result in harm to consumers. The benefits of this merger are inadequate and in some cases unsubstantiated, and then finally taken in its totality, not in the public interest.
Can you go over the differences between what the normal channels are to complete a process like this as it compares to this expedited review?
The original application has been more than a year in process. As I mentioned, the first public hearing for this application for acquisition took place in December, so almost a year ago. After that, there's briefs that are filed, there's deliberation, there's evidentiary hearings, there's discovery, there's all sorts of procedural things that happen whereby different parties that are intervening in the case have an opportunity to raise issues, where the applicants, Exelon and Pepco, have an opportunity to resolve those issues or to provide more information to clarify some of the concerns. This took more than a year to occur before the DCPSC was able to reach a conclusion. What we're looking at now is a settlement that has a lot of new information. It has something like 120 conditions in it. What they're allowing for to unpack those conditions to give new parties an opportunity to intervene and participate in this proceeding, to allow for the public to review it, to allow for public comments, to allow for evidentiary hearings, is about 2 months. Okay, so that's the difference. We're talking about a 2 month period with additional time for deliberation, so maybe the difference between a year and 3 months. Now, that in itself is a problem. But the fact that they're able to do it is perhaps even as problematic, if not more. So when the Public Service Commission rejected the takeover, that was a final order. What Exelon had an opportunity to do at that point was to appeal directly to the PSC, and pending that, appeal directly to a district appeals court. That was what the process should have looked like. They would have had those two options in addition to just reapplying, starting the proceedings all over again. What they did instead was kind of rewrite or carve a new path that didn't exist and ask the PSC to reopen the record and allow for the settlement to be considered within the existing record. The way that they did that was by basically saying, your final order is not actually final, and so you can still consider the settlement within the record, and we don't need to open up a new proceeding or a new application. The fact that they were allowed to get into the existing record and the fact that they were approved for this expedited schedule is very problematic, and a precedent that we don't want to have set here in the district and for other public interest groups that are trying to do the same thing, protect their consumers, protect their local energy. So it's something that everybody should be watching.
I've been talking with Allison Fisher, Outreach Director at Public Citizens Energy Program. For more information, you can visit their website at citizen.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
The United States House of Representatives has elected Paul Ryan to be the 54th Speaker of the House just this morning. The Wisconsin Republican and former 2012 vice presidential candidate was selected by his Republican colleagues to replace outgoing Speaker John Boehner, who announced his resignation earlier this month. As Ryan prepares to take over the fractious House, his path to speakership was not without some conflict.
The House is broken. We're not solving problems. We're adding to them. And I am not interested in laying blame. We are not settling scores. We are wiping the slate clean.
He's going to face a divided Republican Party, notably by the highly conservative Tea Party-affiliated Freedom Caucus, which takes credit for pushing Speaker Boehner towards resignation. Ryan was encouraged to run after the second-in-line House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy dropped out of the running. McCarthy faced disapproval for referring to the lengthy House Benghazi investigations as being positive because it lowered Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton's poll numbers. Ryan has served as chairman of the powerful Budget and Ways Means Committee during his nearly 17 years in Congress.
China's ruling Communist Party announced Thursday that the country will start allowing couples to have two children, abolishing an unpopular policy that has limited many urban families to only one child for the last three decades. A statement from the party's central committee, carried by the official Xinhua news agency, said the decision to allow couples to have two children was to improve the balanced development of population and to deal with an aging population. Xinhua said the proposal must be approved by the top legislature before it is enacted, which is a formality. The decision may not spur a huge baby boom, in part because fertility rates are believed to be declining even without the policy's enforcement. Previous easings of the one-child policy have spurred fewer births than expected, and many people among China's younger generations see smaller family sizes as ideal. The announcement followed the Central Committee panel's meeting this week to chart the country's economic and social development through 2020. In recent years, it has been unusual for such plenary decisions to result in such major decisions. They generally focus on economic topics, and there was no indication that this would take action on the one-child policy. The abrupt fall in birth rates has pushed up the average age of the population, and demographers foresee a looming crisis because the policy has reduced the young labor pool that must support the large baby boom generation as it retires.
Government investigators have blamed the United States Environmental Protection Agency for a 3-million-gallon wastewater spill from a Colorado gold mine. They say that an EPA cleanup crew rushed its work and failed to consider the complex engineering involved, and that triggered the very blowout that they were hoping to avoid. Interior Department investigators concluded that the spill that fouled rivers in three states would have been avoided if the EPA had checked the water levels inside the Gold King mine before digging into its entrance. The investigators' report has implications across the United States because there are hundreds of thousands of abandoned mines that have yet to be cleaned up. The report also finds that the root causes of the accident began several decades earlier with changes made by mining companies that altered the flow of groundwater through a series of interconnected tunnels in the extensively mined Upper Animas watershed. EPA documents show that its officials knew about the potential for a major blowout from the Gold King mine near Silverton, Colorado, as early as June of 2014. EPA officials described the blowout as probably inevitable because so much water had built up inside the mine. The Interior report says that the cleanup could have used a drill rig to bore into the mine from above in order to gauge the danger of a blowout. The engineers stopped short of blaming any individuals, despite prior claims from EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy that the probe would determine if any negligence was involved. A U.S. Army Corps of Engineers official who reviewed the report expressed serious reservations about the EPA's failure to explain exactly how its communications broke down or to justify why its officials were so insistent on starting work without more information about the engineering complexities involved. A separate investigation into the spill is pending from the EPA Investigators General Office. The accident fouled rivers in Colorado, in Utah, and in New Mexico, and temporarily shut down drinking water supplies and also cropland irrigation.
The hole in the ozone layer over Antarctica is measuring at record levels according to the UN's Weather and Climate Agency. However, the agency says that there is no cause for alarm as it should shrink again. The ozone layer, which absorbs most of the sun's ultraviolet radiation, recorded a record-sized hole on October 2nd to a peak of 10.9 million square miles, bigger than Canada and Russia put together. The ozone hole over Antarctica regularly fluctuates in size, normally reaching its widest in the polar spring. This year, a colder-than-usual stratosphere is being blamed for the larger-than-normal measurements. Last year, the World Meteorological Organization said it detected the first sign of ozone recovery, largely thanks to a 1987 ban on gases that cause ozone depletion. However, the organization said it could be a decade before the hole begins shrinking.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth look at a dispute over the selling of what people thought was a public park in Gladstone, Oregon. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6 o'clock, and at 7 it'll be Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be cold and wet, with a high of around 60 and a low of around 60, and as much as half an inch of rain. Today in history, in 1792, Mount Hood was sighted by a member of Captain George Vancouver's crew from what is now Sovey Island, and he named it after a British admiral who had fought against the revolutions in both America and France. The mountain had been known as Wai'ist to the local Multnomah tribe for generations. Today also marks the founding of the Red Cross in 1863. Also, the crash of the New York Stock Exchange in 1929, which was known as Black Tuesday and marked the beginning of the Great Depression. The quote for today is from the French writer Jean Giraudoux. Only the mediocre are always at their best.
It's 5:28, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
At last, America's political leaders indicate that they now feel the pain of the poor and of the millions of working families slipping out of the middle class. Congress had previously paid no attention to the ever-widening chasm between the rich and the rest of us, but it has recently emerged as a central issue for such Republican presidential contenders as Jeb Bush, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, and Marco Rubio. They're publicly lamenting the wealth gap and, by gollies, proposing solutions. Alas, though, the solution proposed by each of them is not to provide help for those who've been knocked down, but to offer aid to the same corporate elites who've been knocking down the middle class and holding down the poor. Specifically, their solution is to cut taxes on corporations and the rich, do away with environmental and labor protections, and cut or privatize government programs, from Head Start to Social Security, that ordinary people count on. For example, Senator Rubio proposes to kill the food stamp program, even though the need for it is greater than ever, and redirect that money into what he calls a subsidy for low-wage workers. Does he think we have sucker wrappers around our heads? That's not a subsidy for workers, but for low-wage employers. Why should taxpayers subsidize the poverty pay of profitable giants like McDonald's, rather than making them pay living wages and cover their own labor costs? This is Jim Hightower saying, I guess we should count it as progress that candidates are at least having to admit that inequality is a problem. But come on, offering the same old failed anti-government snake oil is an insult to the American people. Jeb Bush shows how vacuous their flim-flammery is by saying that, to address the ever-widening wealth and income gap, he'll, quote, celebrate success and cherish free enterprise. Gosh, what a comfort that'll be to America's hard-hit majority, huh?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Presidential candidate Bernie Sanders this week made a statement calling for the implementation of a postal bank. If enacted, the bank would enable people to open checking and savings accounts at their local post offices. For more on this, Cable's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Matt Stenard of Commonomics.
I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit about the concept of postal banking. What does that actually mean?
Certainly. Thank you so much for having me. Postal banking is something that is actually practiced in most countries in the world. It is simply where people bank through their post office. So the Postal Service also functions as a publicly owned bank, a bank that is like a public utility. In the United States, people banked at the post office between the years 1911 and 1967. People opened small savings accounts there. They did remittances and a number of things that the post office still does, but there were also other financial services that the post office no longer does. And so the advocacy of bringing back postal banking is a way of serving communities right now of people who don't have community banks to go to, don't have big banks to go to, and therefore end up paying more in fees and for other services. They're part of what is known as the underbanked population. And so the proposal by Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and others to reopen postal banks is a way for the poor to have access to inexpensive banking.
And what impact will this have on, say, the payday lending industry that tends to target impoverished neighborhoods and areas?
Certainly. One of the proposals for postal banking would be possibly for the postal bank to be able to either paycheck advances or advance small loans at extremely low interest rates for consumers. Right now, the payday loan industry is very predatory. The interest rates that they charge are anywhere from 350 to 400%. The people who take out those loans are typically desperate. They include domestic violence victims who are trying to gain independence, and of course, in general, poor working people who might have a disaster. Right now, about half of all Americans could not weather a $400 emergency. That's where the payday loan industry tends to move in, and so the ability to do paycheck advances or small loans through the Postal Service would essentially put those payday lenders out of business because, again, you would have a public utility giving people a public option instead of having to turn to those lenders.
The U.S. Postal Service has been a major target of the conservative right in Congress. What would be the impact of a postal banking system on the U.S. Postal Service?
We think, at Commonomics, we think that the impact would be very positive for the Postal Service. It would make them even more financially solvent than they already are. In fact, one of the conservative attacks that you are speaking of is the Postal Accountability Act of 2006, which basically artificially inflates the financial burden of the post office in a lot of unpalatable ways. In fact, but for that prohibitive legislation, the Postal Service would run at a profit. They don't take any tax money right now, which is something not a lot of people know. And they actually enjoy a very favorable rating in public opinion polls. And so we think that opening up financial services through the post office would allow them to make a small profit on the services that they perform, and would make them even more financially solvent than they already are. But it would also stem the tide of privatization, because there would be more reason for these branches, for these individual branches, to stay open. And right now, the branch closures that are constantly being threatened really threaten to hurt people in rural communities as well as urban poor communities, places where, you know, they don't have banks to go to, and they would have to rely on expensive private carriers to do their packages and mail if those branches close down. So this would also be a way to revitalize those individuals.
Well, I want to thank you for this. Again, I've been speaking with Matt Stannard. He is a policy director at Commonomics USA, and their website, commonomicsusa.org. His latest article is on truthout.org. Postal banks are people's banks. Six things to know about postal banking. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The UAW's GM Council approved the proposed tentative contract with GM Wednesday. The 52,000 UAW workers at GM will now vote on whether or not to ratify that agreement. At a press conference in Detroit, UAW President Dennis Williams said this agreement is a strong contract.
We believe this agreement gives UAW members significant raises and a stronger benefits, and will strengthen members and their families, our communities, and our union. By standing strong and united together, the bargaining committee secured better pay, a clear path to the traditional wages for all current members, and commitments to keeping jobs and products here.
Amazon warehouse workers at the Port of Los Angeles launched a strike Wednesday as striking port truckers continued their picketing. The Amazon warehouse workers from Cal Cartage Warehouse are supported by the Teamsters Union, as are the truckers. Among the things the truckers want are classification as employees, the right to form a union, immediate company repair of unsafe trucks, dignified break rooms, and a place to prepare meals and rest during their long work days.
I'm very confident that we'll win this election. Ultimate goal has always been to get a contract, and this is just one of the avenues that we see to try to get some of our members already started and already in and get a contract. We've had a lot of outside interference before. Hopefully we won't have it now. Hopefully we can let the people there in the plant that work there every day decide this election this time.
UAW Local 42 President Mike Cantrell talking about an upcoming NLRB election for skilled trades workers at VW's Chattanooga, Tennessee plant. Cantrell says the local meets regularly with VW management and is still working toward getting a collective bargaining agreement. He says he expects expects the skilled trades union representation election to happen by mid-November. Cantrell says workers at VW need union representation, and unions are good for America's middle class.
I'm more pro-worker, pro-middle class, pro-labor than anything else. We all know we've had a shrinking middle class for the last couple of decades, and our tax base is shrinking, our wages are shrinking, and the rich continue to get richer. The poor are left behind, and the middle class still continues to be overtaxed, overworked. And one of the only avenues that I see is collective bargaining, people unionizing, getting together, asking for what's fair, and trying to level the playing field and have checks and balances. And that's what we're trying to do.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers and its 1.6 million members working to reclaim the promise of public education, health care, and public services for our students, their families, and our communities. More information online at aft.org.
If you like what you hear in this newscast, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and visit laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Egypt is the most populous country in the Arab world. However, most of those people are crowded into a tiny corridor right along the Nile River, and they're surrounded by the vast Sahara Desert. This has led to a critically tight water supply. Because of treaties with nations along the upper reaches of the Nile, Egypt is limited to 55 billion cubic meters of fresh water from the river annually, which must be stretched to cover an estimated demand for 80 billion cubic meters. Naturally, the country has invested a considerable amount of money and effort into finding a cheap way to desalinate water, which would make salt water from the Mediterranean and also the Red Sea available for human use. Now it looks as though scientists at Alexandria University have developed a membrane that can both clean and desalinate water. This is according to a paper published last week in the journal Water Science and Technology. The membrane is made using materials that are found right there in North Africa, and it uses about half as much energy as previous methods. The membrane's developers have stated that they plan to mass produce it soon, including sheets for individual use. If the membrane lives up to the hype, it could have positive effects far beyond the country of Egypt. Experts have predicted that water security will be a major driver of conflict and mass migration in coming years as climate change and overpopulation hit already arid regions.
The millions of plastic bags dumped into our oceans each year are making their way to the North Pole. The Alfred Wegener Institute for Polar and Marine Research in Germany has, for the first time, found marine litter on the surface of Arctic waters. Plastic bag litter and other floating plastic debris have never before been seen north of the Arctic Circle. According to the Institute, there are currently five massive plastic garbage patches in the world's oceans, and this patch could be a sixth in the early stages of formation. According to a recent study published in the journal Science, 8 million tons of plastic is dumped into the ocean each year.
Raif Badawi is a blogger who was tried and convicted in Saudi Arabia on charges including apostasy and insulting Islam. He was sentenced in the year 2014 to 10 years in prison and 1,000 lashes. Badawi was declared a prisoner of conscience by Amnesty International following his arrest back in 2012. The European Parliament today announced that it is awarding Badawi this year's Sakharov Prize for Freedom of Thought. The Sakharov Prize is awarded each year to an individual who have made an exceptional contribution to the fight for human rights across the globe.
The U.S. military and allied forces dropped 13 bombs in Iraq last night, killing an unknown number of people. The military issued a statement that last night's airstrikes were targeted at fighters with the Daesh movement, known in English as ISIS. According to the military, the bombs hit Daesh weapons, boats, fighting positions, and other targets near six Iraqi cities, including Ramadi and Mosul. Meanwhile, the CBC released a report today that Canadian fighter jets have been linked to another incident of bombing civilians. The airstrike in question was carried out on December 21, 2014. The Canadian military have claimed that the bomb was dropped on a weapons factory, but video footage showed a woman and child who were hit in the attack. This is the second case of alleged civilian casualties linked to Canadian bombers. The first, on January 21st in northern Iraq, was dismissed by the Canadian military as non-credible. The new Canadian Prime Minister made it his first act in office to announce the withdrawal of Canadian troops from the U.S.-led war in Iraq.
On the island of Lesbos, off the coast of Greece, volunteers are working around the clock to try to rescue refugees from capsized boats. 11 people, including several children, have drowned yesterday when their boat capsized. The high winds and storms off the coast shattered several of the wooden fishing boats carrying refugees from Turkey. The Greek Coast Guard said they rescued 242 people from the capsized boats. One of the volunteers, a teacher at Leeds University, said the harbor in Lesbos yesterday was a scene of half-drowned children and of volunteers trying to resuscitate them. She told reporters from The Guardian that about a third of the people rescued on Wednesday were children younger than 5 years old, mainly from Syria, with at least 25 of them suffering from serious shock, from hypothermia, and from other injuries.
A leaked email has revealed that editors from newspapers in at least five states owned by the Georgia-based Morris Communications Company were ordered by their parent company to print an Islamophobic op-ed in their newspapers. The op-ed opposes President Obama's plan to provide asylum to 65,000 refugees from Syria and making sweeping generalizations about Islam. The refugees, according to the editorial, will destroy America. The papers were told to print the editorial without altering its position or naming an author. A leaked email containing those instructions has surfaced when a whistleblower within one of the papers decided to reveal the editorial control being pushed on the paper to print a piece of anti-Islamic propaganda. All but one of Morris's 11 daily newspapers printed the piece without changes during the third week in September.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imamc.org, for Thursday, October 29th, 2015. Two Palestinian civilians were killed by Israeli gunfire. Meanwhile, clashes continue all over the occupied West Bank, Jerusalem, and Gaza. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned.